Hello, dear listeners. My name is Olga Lukina. I'm a board-certified behavior analyst and certified occupational therapist. The main goal of this podcast is to inform families who raise children with autism, as well as specialist teachers and other interested listeners, about the difficulties and the scientifically approved therapies and methods to improve the quality of life of people with autism. Today we'll have a great conversation on the topic sleep problems in people with autism and effective treatment, with doctoral level board certified behavior analyst Kylan Turner. So welcome to episode 5. Hello, Kylan and Deirdre. Thank you for attending my podcast. And I look forward to discussing today's topic. This is sleep problems in people with autism and effective treatment. I know that Kylan specializes in caregiver training to address sleep problems and feeding problems in children with autism. So can you introduce yourself, and also can you give a little bit more information about the areas of interest in applied behavior analysis? You both, of course.
Hey, great. Well, I'll go first. My name is Kylan Turner, board certified behavior analyst. I've been working in the field actually since 2001, 2002. I started working with kids with autism when I was in high school. So I always joke it's been my only job. I have always had an interest in working with families because I started off serving families doing applied behavior analysis in their homes. So for me, most of my interests have come from trying to support families. What are the areas that the typical service system doesn't serve them? So a school teaches kids academic skills. The community might teach different adaptive skills, social skills, but what can be taught in the home to directly benefit for the families? So that's where my interest in sleep really arose, was I would meet with families and they would say, oh, we were up all night and it's just awful. And I know what it feels like to be up late at night and miss sleep, and it is awful. And then you have a child with special needs who was also up all night. So to me, it felt like an area that was not being addressed. And when I learned that behavior analysis can address it, I thought, wow, this is great. So that was really what developed my interest in that. I also have a strong interest in working with families to address feeding problems. As a result of some of the work that I did, I have a great interest, not just in single subject design, but also group design and statistical analysis, and finding ways for our field to be able to disseminate our data to other multidisciplinary fields. A lot of medical providers and people from other disciplines don't quite understand our research. And I think that that's an area that we should try to be translational have our work be recognized to be just as effective and sometimes more effective and safer than medicine, biological interventions, such as medications. So those are really my passion areas. And I'm really delighted I get to teach at Simmons University, and I have a student in my doctoral lab, Deirdre Smith, who's joining here. And I don't know if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Kylan. I am also a board certified behavior analyst. I started in the field in 2013, really in the field of ABA. Before that, I had some exposure through coaching Special Olympic swim teams. And that's where I kind of really found my love for working with children with autism, and have been in the field since 2013, obtained my certification. Throughout that, I worked in a number of different settings and have been involved in sleep treatments for some students with severe sleep disturbances. So wanting to sleep during the day and staying up all night, or short sporadic sleep patterns. One of my passions is really cross-cultural ABA. So right now I work at a school for the deaf. We serve multitative students, including students who have autism spectrum disorder. All of our students are either deaf or hard of hearing. And ABA hasn't really been brought into the field or into the deaf community as much. So it's kind of my passion to try and bring that to the deaf community right now.
Thank you so much. I try to be reinforcing listener to reinforce your speaker's behavior. Yeah. Okay.
Your audience behavior is fantastic.
Okay, great. So let's start our structured discussion about sleep. Can you describe the types of sleep problems children with autism face? And how specifically do these sleep problems affect children's development and behavior?
Sure. So there are actually two categories of sleep disturbances in the sleep literature at large. One category is called dyssomnias, and these are difficulties initiating or maintaining sleep. So this would be a situation where, and maybe we've all experienced this at some point or another, either, you know, briefly for a few nights or long term, but essentially they have a hard time falling asleep. And even though the family's rule is they need to be in bed by 8, they're not falling asleep until 3 hours later or something like that. And then there's also maintaining sleep. So, you know, once an individual falls asleep, it's expected that they will be able to stay asleep until morning or until, you know, a sufficient period has passed. And so I just want to put two sort of qualifiers on that. Difficulty initiating sleep. Typically, what our goal is, and we'll talk about this when we talk about treatment, our goal is for all of us to be able to say, wow, I'm tired, it's been a long day, lay down in bed, and then within 20 minutes of the room being dark and the blankets being adjusted to our comfort, for us to fall asleep. Anything longer than about 20 minutes is considered delayed sleep onset. And so that's something I just want to qualify. When we talk about treatment in a little bit, we'll talk about how to get there. But that's typically what we expect. If you're a good sleeper, then you're you know, falling asleep within that range. Clinically, it's diagnosed as difficulty falling asleep if it's beyond that 20 minutes. One other thing I want to say before we start talking about treatment in a little bit is that maintaining sleep is also an interesting thing. Until I started studying this, I didn't know this. Actually, all of us, typically developing individuals, people who would report, I don't have any sleep problems, actually do wake up in the night, usually every couple of hours. If you're a good sleeper, you have learned a skill. And that skill is, I'm going to wake up, I'm going to adjust, I'm going to move my body around in my bed, I might shift my pillow around, I might just change my sleeping position to be more comfortable, and I go back to sleep. If you are good at that skill, you don't remember that you did that. If you aren't so great at that skill of finding out how to be comfortable and making it so, you may stay awake. And then you end up with night wakings, which lots of kids, as we'll talk about, typically developing and otherwise, have to learn that skill. So I think the most fascinating part about sleep behavior is that it is, interestingly enough, a skill that we all learn, hopefully. And it isn't this, you know, always destined to be this thing that is a problem forever. It can be learned. And as a behavior analyst, of course, that's really exciting to think, okay, what are the variables that we can manipulate to make it so that we can teach sleep behavior? And we'll talk about there are exceptions, of course, to every rule. But in general, I always think of that as like a helpful principle to think about with sleep. So those are dyssomnias. And then there's also a category called parasomnias. These are slightly less common. These are arousals during sleep, like sleepwalking, and, you know, essentially just engaging in other behaviors during sleep. I would say the dyssomnias are probably the most common, the ones I just talked about, difficulty initiating or maintaining sleep, waking up really early for the day, just having a less consistent sleep pattern.
Okay, I want to be your doctoral student too now. You know so much about this. Well, yeah.
Sometimes it's just one area, but yeah.
Great. Okay. So I read on autismspeaks.com that about 4 from 5 children with autism can have sleep problems. But what really is the prevalence of sleep problems?
Sure. So 4 out of 5 would be 80%, right? And I think that's just about right. I actually have done studies that were sponsored through Autism Speaks before. And so it's an interesting thing, this whole idea of sleep and autism and the research, because we actually have a range, and it's an accepted range of prevalence. And it's across multiple studies dating back from 1995 up until about 2009, and perhaps more recently, that have reported a range of 44% to 83%. And, you know, that's a wide range. But when you actually look at those individual studies, the methods for those studies vary quite a bit. Some of the studies, you know, they vary in terms of their sample size, but they also vary in terms of what tools they use to diagnose or determine that a sleep problem is present. Self-report is one measure. You know, how often they ask parents, how often is your child waking up in the night? And parents report that. Well, that's going to be a little bit faulty in certain respects. Not that we don't trust parents, but some parents are deep sleepers. They might not know that their child is waking up a lot, right? Also, it could be that their child is waking up and just not making, you know, making themselves known as being awake. They're just sort of settling in bed, et cetera. So it sort of depends on the nature of the sleep problem to say that self-report is going to be identified. And also, there's some cultural aspects to it also. If a parent isn't disturbed by the sleep problem because they are a light sleeper themselves, they might underreport that there's a sleep problem. But that doesn't mean that the sleep problem isn't there and probably affecting the child's development. So self-report was relied upon for a long time for you know, the methods of certain studies. We've since gotten really good at objective measurements of sleep, wherein an individual might have, you know, on the other end of the continuum, go into a sleep lab and have various monitors set up to measure their sleep behavior. That kind of has its own issues because it's a little bit more artificial and the actual measurement may actually impede sleep. And then you've got something in between where you might give them an activity monitor. We call it an actigraph. On their wrist or on their ankle, where you measure how much they move, and there's an algorithm that detects whether or not they're actually awake versus asleep. And so I give you 3 examples of ways it's been measured in the literature, and you know, maybe that gives you an idea of how each study has come out with different prevalence rates of a problem. Also, just in terms of questionnaires, this idea of this 20-minute interval of being able to fall asleep within 20 minutes of being in bed, that was established by some, you know, criteria, but not universally used until recently. And so there is a range, but I would say 4 out of 5 children with autism experiencing a sleep problem at some point between the ages of 3 and 15 years makes sense. I think we have to qualify what constitutes the length of the problem. Is it just once a week? Is it 5 times a week? I'm not sure on that threshold for everyone, but I would say that makes a lot of sense that at least at some point in time, this can become a problem. And as we will talk about, if you don't address the problem early and start teaching those skills around sleep and start creating an environment for appropriate sleep to happen, that little problem could persist and become the norm for the individual when it comes to sleep.
Yeah, I think it's important to mention that it can affect in future the quality of life of the whole family. So maybe you can give some more information about the research in this field, in this problem.
Sure. Well, I guess I encourage anyone who's listening to this to ask themselves the last time they were really sleep deprived, what was it like? You know, I think we've all been there. And it really, I think the best way to put it is that it colors the way you see the world when you're very sleep deprived. Things that maybe wouldn't make you anxious or wouldn't make you angry or irritable, they do. The world affects you differently. You don't have that resilience to be able to handle what's going on in your world because you haven't had sufficient rest to be able to handle it. So your arousal system is definitely jolted and jostled, right? Specifically, the research on the implications of sleep problems for children with autism, if it is chronic and prolonged, it will impact their neurological development. We know that sleep is essential for young developing brains. So neurological development, you know, it runs the risk of impacting that. Learning, as I mentioned, let's put ourselves in the position of someone who stayed up all night and tries to go to school all day. How can you retain all of that information? Your attention is really minimal at that point. You don't, you know, have the ability to attend. Memory consolidation is definitely trickier in this regard. So there've been a lot of different studies that have been that have evaluated that. One area that I focused on a lot is daytime challenging behavior. So again, I put myself in the shoes of someone who's sleep deprived. My challenging behavior might not be a tantrum looking the same as a child with autism, but I will be difficult to be around if I'm severely sleep deprived. And that makes sense that children with autism who already have challenges negotiating the day, getting through the day and demands and confronting various stimuli, then on top of that being, you know, too tired. So I think the difficulty for parents of children with autism who have sleep problems is sort of how much of this is the diagnosis and the challenges that we face all the time, and how much of it is exacerbated by the fact that they are tired and then the family is tired. And so they're dealing with it in a challenging way too, because they don't have the patience anymore that they might have on a better day when they've had sleep. Mm-hmm. So it's really about setting oneself up for success, right? When we have a big day ahead of us, we say, I got to get some good sleep for tomorrow. You know, if you're already starting off without that, it's going to affect everything that comes after.
Yeah, I think this is a good point that the specialist need to, when he says problem behavior, he needs to take into consideration also the sleep problems or feeding problems, etc. Not just looking what is the function of the behavior in this environment. And I think this is really like a point for a specialist and the parent that we need to watch and assess broadly what happens in mm-hmm. this situation.
Yeah, I want to add one other thing I just thought of. There was a study that came out in 2013 on the consequences of sleep deprivation. And it was talking more broadly about what we should be thinking about as sleep specialists. And the current wisdom is that we should treat sleep first. So if we've got folks who have anxiety or post-traumatic stress disorder or depression, I'm not even talking just about autism, but if they've got those symptoms or diagnoses, if we encourage sleep or promote sleep, it's possible that that anxiety, that post-traumatic stress disorder and depressive symptoms, that those will be better as a result of getting more sleep. So treating sleep first may bring down those elements. When we think about autism and the different presentations across the spectrum with anxiety, with depression, with all of the increased stress of the household, obsessive compulsive disorders are a part of that, anxiety piece. All of that, may come down. I often think of getting good sleep as sort of turning down the volume on some of the existing issues that could be present, because you do have more resilience when you have slept. Your body and your brain are able to make it through the day in a different way when you've had that. And so I thought that was a pretty neat study that looked at the impact that just getting good sleep has on these very challenging disorders. And so I think the same could be said for the things that we see in autism.
So can you say and can you comment that sleep problems can affect sensory input and, for example, sensory overload problems more?
Absolutely. I think that, when you think about one's system of arousal in the body, really what sensory processing is, a hyper or hypo arousal and responsiveness to certain stimuli. So again, I think of if you can regulate that, everybody's body is a little bit different. For the most part, people require a set number of hours of sleep a day. But if you aren't well regulated to what your body needs on a given day, then you're more or less likely to be responding within normal limits to certain sensory stimuli. So I think, I haven't seen specific literature on that. I haven't searched for it, so I'll just be honest, but I think that it stands to reason that there's something very protective about getting good sleep. And if sensory processing is part of it, then it all kind of feeds into that same system.
Okay, thank you. So I think we can move to the therapy process a little bit. Okay. So how do specialists assess sleep problems and how do they objectively measure the improvements after that, like baseline and improvements?
Sure. I think, we talked a little bit about, or I talked a little bit about this when I was talking about the types of sleep problems. Traditionally, it would be more of a questionnaire and questionnaire about sleep, and it's considered a self-report. The parents are reporting on their child's behavior. Again, there's just a reliability question there, depending on all of that. Parents should be sleeping. They shouldn't be sitting by their kid's bed, measuring how much their child is sleeping. So it's fair that parents don't always know what's going on with their child's sleep. They can see in the morning if their kid slept well or not, perhaps, but it's not as objective. And so more and more there, easier and easier ways to objectively measure sleep. I mentioned the actigraph. If anyone knows what a Fitbit is, or one of those exercise monitors you put on your wrist, it has a mechanism in there that is ultimately what we call an actigraph. And what that does is it just measures movement. And when we are awake, we engage in certain movements, a certain number of times per minute, let's say. You could measure heart rate, things like that. All of these objective physiological and activity-based measurements are very objective. And like I said, they've built algorithms to be able to say any movement above this threshold means the person's awake. If there's no movement for this period of time, it means that they're asleep. Those are really helpful because they're unobtrusive. You never want your measurement system to interfere with the behavior itself. So taking a child with autism and putting them into a sleep lab, which is a brand new environment, it's artificial, it's not what they're used to, they're going to sleep poorly. And then you've measured poor sleep, but we all kind of know why, right? It's impacted the integrity of what it's meant to measure, right? So an actigraph is really effective at that, at addressing, you know, at measuring what we need to measure, but doing it in an unobtrusive way. And so those are our objective measures. Usually what will happen is if parents suspect a sleep problem, they'll go to their pediatrician and they'll say, I think my child has a sleep problem. The pediatrician will probably give some questionnaires and self-reports. And depending on, you know, I'm not sure how it is in other countries, but at least I can report on in the United States, if the sleep problem is reported to be significant enough, then it might be that there are additional, I have to gather my thoughts. I don't know how to explain this in a way that would make sense for people outside of the US, but the doctor might order for more tests to be done, more measurements to be taken of that, assessment to be taken. But personally, my recommendation would be if any specialist, anyone working with a child hears that there's a suspicion of a sleep problem, that there are very easy steps to take to address it without the use of medication or something more intrusive.
Okay. So if a child refuses to wear this device on his wrist, you just put it when he's asleep. After he's asleep, or how do you manage these problems?
So that's a great question. So for different research studies, we actually trained the kids to wear them. We would, during the day, introduce it, maybe have a light watch, like a very inexpensive one, just to get used to it being on their wrist. If we knew that they wouldn't like it on their wrist, you can actually put it on their ankle. It's just as good. And we would basically desensitize it. And have it on all day and they would get used to it. Those were the ways that we were able to do it for the sake of research studies. I think for the audience that we're talking to today, parents of children with autism, my recommendation is if you suspect that your child has a sleep problem, go to, you know, your pediatrician, and see what, you know, can be offered, what services could be offered if you feel like you need those. But I think most of the time families know if this is what is going on and they can report that generally. If additional assessments need to be done, I would push for an actigraph and not necessarily a sleep study in a lab measuring it that way. Sorry, I should have been more concise with that answer.
That's okay. Yeah. So, and the specialist uses this measurement, take a measurement just to compare with the results after that.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. So they would take the baseline measurement and say they're waking up, you know, 5 times a night before we do any intervention. They're waking up at 4 a.m. and staying up. And then once they do intervention, they can say, oh, wow, he's sleeping until 7 a.m. We've added 3 hours of sleep and the sleep has become more consolidated or something like that.
Okay, great. So we will have an interesting part now. Let's speak about effective treatment of sleep problems. And for now, can you describe the types of interventions? I mean, in general, like behavioral, medical, and et cetera. And after that, we can speak in details about behavioral interventions.
Great. Well, I want to say historically, when a child was exhibiting sleep problems, they needed to be pretty severe for a physician or someone else to tell the family, yes, your child has sleep problems and we need to address this. So in those severe cases, what often happened, and this was in the past, was just medication was being provided. The problem with that the medications I'm talking about are really like nervous system depressants, like benzodiazepine or Klonopin for, you know, which is actually like an anti-epileptic, but, or anti-convulsant. Those are pretty severe medications, and there's actually not sufficient safety and efficacy data on that. You're essentially sedating the child, which has its own problems, because then there are side effects. There's grogginess the next day. The child hasn't gotten good sleep. They've just been sedated. And so that doesn't really solve the problem. It might solve the problem in terms of families getting sleep and being able to be okay the next day, but the child themselves hasn't learned that skill of falling asleep. They haven't learned that skill of putting themselves back to sleep when they wake up. So it's really a missed opportunity as a behaviorist, I would say, for all of that to be taught. There are other things that can help that are not, that are safe. So melatonin is a naturally, it's naturally found in the body. And it, you know, the supplements that you would take would have been made in a lab, but when you take those, they often help initiate sleep. Sometimes they sort of wear off or wane, and then the child ends up still having night wakings, but melatonin is, I think, a safe approach to take under the advisement of a physician. Then, of course, as a behavior analyst, I'm most interested in how can we get long-term effective change here. I think of sleep as a skill. So there are lots of different interventions that you can do. And I like to classify them into one of two areas. One is preventative. In our field, we call them antecedent-based interventions. The other is consequence-based. When I think of antecedent-based interventions, I think of how do we set the stage for success for sleep? One universal way would be really positive bedtime routines. And that's where we take a look at the child's schedule and we say, are they getting enough exercise? Are they, there are certain sleep hygiene things to think about, not eating a big meal right before bed and expecting the child to go straight to sleep. Their body is digesting that food and they won't go to sleep. So there are certain things we know about sleep that if you try to engineer the day around those elements, you can actually promote sleep. So for some children, it might mean avoiding naps to encourage, we call it an establishing operation, but to promote the motivation for them to want to go to sleep. We also know that kids with autism have stimulus control issues. So one thing that you would want to do is make the sleep environment as simple as possible so that they don't require a lot of complicated elements to be in place to go back to sleep. So if they have a train set and it has to be set up a certain way and they need a very specific pillow in a very specific location, all of those things have to be replicated if they wake up in the night and they're not there, right? And they're not perfect. If they fall asleep with a parent, that parent is going to have to come back in to help that child go back to sleep. So we want to be cognizant of all of those issues or all of those stimuli that are present to fall asleep, that they will need to be present again to fall back asleep. And it creates an over-reliance. So those are some antecedent interventions. Also, I'm trying to think, Deirdre, is there anything that you can think of just knowing children with autism and the need for consistency?
Yes, specifically related to the stimulus control. When we're discussing setting up the environment to signal sleep, making sure that the child is only in their bed when it's time for bed, or their bedroom. So for students I've done sleep treatment with in the past, they stayed out of their bedroom for the whole day. They weren't in their bedroom, playing in their bedroom, or in their bed outside of the time where it was time to fall asleep. So that way the bed signaled sleep versus if a student is in there laying on their bed and watching TV or reading a book, like Kylan mentioned, the bed's going to be associated with that. And if they're using reading a book or TV to fall asleep, they're going to need that if they wake up during the middle of the night. So really it's the bed and the bedroom should signal, okay, I'm in here. My body knows it's time to sleep and I'll be asleep within that 20 minute window.
That's great. I love that idea of restricting the space just to be for sleep. I always, when I explain this to families, I always ask them, when you go to bed at night, what does it look like for you? And no one ever has to answer that. But, you know, we all have our own favorite way of falling asleep, right? We know that we like a lot of blankets or we don't like a lot of blankets. We know that we like one pillow versus two pillows, right? All of us have learned this about ourselves, hopefully. And we know how to construct that environment to be just so. And when, to the point, when we go to a hotel room or stay at a friend's house, we will try to approximate that the best we can. Okay. So what we need to do for kids who are having difficulty with this is take a mental snapshot, take a picture of that space that is effectively allowing the child to fall asleep. When we take that snapshot, we can say, okay, this is what's required. These are the variables. These are the stimuli in their place. Over time, maybe we say, this is a complicated setup. We have to have the TV on. We have to have a white noise machine. We have to have like a strobe light going, like, you know, all these things in place. Maybe over time, we want to fade some of those out to make it easier for them to go to sleep with just a couple of pieces that need to be in place. That's easier for the child to control when they wake up naturally at 3 a.m., but maybe the TV's not on anymore. It went off. And maybe the little light that, you know, projects little characters is off, right? We want to make it simple and we want to make it replicable. And that will help address a lot of what we call those stimulus control issues. We also call them sleep association stimuli. It's what we associate with sleep. So I love that idea of Deirdre's to just keep the bedroom for sleep. It's not for jumping on the bed. It's not for reading. It's not for building with Legos. It's just for sleep. Once they get in there, that will occasion sleep. And so those were some antecedent interventions. Other ones are what we call bedtime fading and sleep restriction. In this case, what we're trying to do,
Okay, he's answering too.
So one thing to think about, I had mentioned eliminating naps and consolidating sleep as best you can. So if a person is not falling asleep until, let's say, 11 p.m., one thing to do is not put them in their bed at 8 p.m. That's just hopeful, wishful thinking, right? You're just hoping that, oh, I'll put them in their bed and they'll fall asleep. Well, maybe they're not tired yet. So it's a little bit difficult to explain to parents who are very sleep deprived, but if their child is not technically falling asleep until 11 p.m., they shouldn't be getting into their bed until 10:40. Because what we want is for as soon as they get into the bed, them to fall asleep. We want to shorten that window that they're in their bed and not sleeping. Over time, if after a couple of weeks of putting them in their bed at 10:40 and not any earlier, what will happen is they will just reliably fall asleep at that time. And what you can do is start waking them up a little earlier and then shifting. So if they're falling asleep at 11 p.m. reliably, but waking up at 8 a.m., what you can do is after you have that reliable falling asleep period established, you can wake them up at, let's say, 7:30, and over time shift it to be that maybe they're actually falling asleep at 9 p.m. and waking up at 6 a.m. And maybe that's more acceptable for the family, right? And what often happens when we make that shift is there are fewer night wakings. And also you can adjust so they're ready for school or whatever the daily routine is. But essentially, finding ways to promote sleep when they're in that space is the best thing to do, antecedent wise, to prevent these issues. And I would say out of all of the work I've ever done as a behavior analyst, the most powerful thing you can do to address sleep problems really does lie in those preventive approaches. Most of the time, if you've done those for very consistently for a period of several weeks, you will bring down the likelihood that these problems are occurring. You'll decrease their frequency, you'll decrease their intensity. When that has happened, as a clinician, I often say, okay, the last thing to do is now look at consequence-based interventions. The tricky part about sleep interventions is that when a child is asleep, we don't wake them up and give them reinforcement, right? Every other skill we teach, as soon as they engage in the appropriate behavior, we reinforce. We say, here's your sticker, here's your praise, right? When they're sleeping, we want to let them sleep. So, and then when they wake up in the morning and they've slept all night, it might not have much significance to tell them, good job sleeping, right? So our consequence-based interventions really should only be applied. Certainly give a sticker board or use whatever thing might work with your client or your child to promote sleep if reinforcement can be helpful. But most of the time, the consequence-based interventions are to address the problems when they occur. And so after you've done several weeks or months of antecedent-based interventions to promote sleep, and you're getting some consistency, and you've done pretty much everything you can with the preventive measures, if you still have night wakings, what do you do? And there's actually an approach, we call it graduated extinction, or we call it, that's the fancy term for it, but really what we are doing is we are putting the child back to sleep on a schedule. So I know you had some examples. I don't want to run into your examples, or I'm just talking now.
That's okay. I think if you run, that's okay. We just skip and take another example or something like that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry, Olga.
That's okay.
I get the tape going in my head. And Deirdre, you have to leave in about 10 minutes. So just scoot when you need to. Awesome. Have you ever done anything around putting kids back to sleep after they've come out of their room or anything?
For night wakings?
Yes.
Definitely have less experience with that. And much more, I kind of was one of the staff that supported the overnights until it was time for bed. But I believe we did with some of our students, because I remember there were a couple times where the student would wake up, was we tried to keep it like as neutral as possible. So not like, hey, how's it going? Like,
yeah,
tried to keep it very low energy. Even thinking about like if we as adults wake up, we're not supposed to do something that's super fun. Like we shouldn't be watching our favorite show on Netflix or doing something like that, but trying to do some neutral, boring activity that would not wake your body up to the point where you're like ready to go.
Right. Good. Yeah. I'll set that up if you want to share that anecdote. Sorry, Olga. It's good to. So what should we do when a child has had all of these preventive strategies or antecedent-based interventions, and they're still either refusing to go to bed, or they are waking up at certain times in the night and not wanting to go back to bed? They're really the same issue. It's just refusal to go to bed initially and then refusal to go back to sleep when they've had that natural wake up. So One approach that at least in the United States we've has been recommended for sleep training infants is to, you know, essentially we call it the cry it out method. And that can be pretty effective and effective immediately. When a tiny baby is learning to go to sleep, the parents put them down to bed and they're safe and they're fine. And they leave the room and they don't go back in the room until it's time to feed or something like that, right? And maybe that, you know, there are different perspectives on how good of an idea that is. But I guess from a behavioral perspective, I will say what ends up happening is that the baby learns that, you know, that crying at certain points in the night won't result in their parent necessarily coming in. The parent will come in at a time that is appropriate, you know, every 2 hours to feed or something like that, right? So that's one approach. The difficulty with asking families to do that with a child who can get up and walk around, who can potentially destroy their room and hurt themselves, is that it's not safe. And so initially when different interventions were being attempted in the literature for families of children with autism, this worked. It worked because behaviorally it works to withdraw attention for waking up at night. Okay. When your child wakes up at night and they don't get anything for waking up at night, they'll eventually go back to sleep. And over time, they will stop getting up and petitioning, requesting attention. The difficulty is what happens in that time while they're learning that is that they might get hurt. And so just closing the door on a child with a developmental disability or problem behavior isn't safe. And what would happen is the parents would still go into the room anyway to make sure their child was safe. So the most acceptable and still effective intervention is to schedule a time to go in and check on the child. So when your child is refusing to go to bed and you know that you're at that window where they're likely to fall asleep, okay, you've established that window and they're still refusing and they're starting to get more agitated and aroused, the thing to do is to help them get into their bed and then walk away. As soon as you close the door, set a timer for 1 minute. Don't go into the room for 1 minute. I'm saying 1 minute, perhaps you start with even smaller, 10 seconds, 30 seconds, something like that. I'm using 1 minute just for the sake of this example. Close the door for 1 minute, the timer goes off. You go into the room. Perhaps the child's still having a tantrum at that point. And perhaps they're trying to knock over their dresser. I don't know. Hopefully, you know, you go in there and they're okay. You put them back into their bed and you close the door. You set the timer for 1 minute. It's a lot to get through. However, what you're doing is you're teaching the child that they will get attention, that they don't need to go to extreme lengths to get attention, that the attention will come every minute on that timer. And then what will happen is the parents are less anxious because they get to see their child. They get to see that their child is okay. And then the child starts to learn, I'm going to get attention either way. Am I going to get myself all worked up and cry and scream and kick and destroy stuff to get attention? Or am I just going to wait for more attention to come? Over time, as the child starts settling back into bed, you stop, right? Once they're asleep, you don't have to keep checking on them. After multiple days of this, multiple weeks of this, you can, and of consistent, easy responding, the child will stop engaging in this problem behavior altogether because they don't have a need to, because the attention is coming their way anyway. You can lengthen that interval from 1 minute to 2 minutes to 3 minutes to 15 minutes to, you know, something longer. But the hope is that you've created enough with those preventive strategies. You've taught them to try to fall asleep in that bed, and they will learn that they will get that attention regardless. So they don't need to wake up in the night to get it. Deirdre has some really good points on what to do when you go into the room. You wouldn't want to go into the room and, you know, have a party and say, hey, I'm in the room with you. I don't know, Deirdre, if you'd like to share what you were saying about keeping it neutral.
Yes, definitely. I think the key there is to make it the least reinforcing possible, I guess. Even if the student or the child isn't super motivated by the attention, providing a lot of attention and energy into the environment, it's going to make it seem more fun and probably signal to the child like, oh yes, it's okay to be awake at this time. So trying to provide consistent messages or limited verbal interactions like, oh, it's time for bed, this is what we're going to do. Like Kylan had mentioned before too, maybe if they want a quick hug, sure, but maybe not like a full snuggle, things like that, maybe briefly. But if the student starts associating with, oh, okay, I wake up, mom comes in, I get a big snuggle and I get to fall asleep in her arms, it's going to be really hard down the road to break that habit. So trying to reset up the environment to signal that sleep again, whether it's, okay, we put the lights off, we do the white noise or whatever it is. And then I believe maybe this is leading into the next point. If they're not asleep, back asleep though in 20 minutes, trying to do some kind of mundane, boring task before trying to sleep again, trying to get the child to sleep again. Mm-hmm. I am going to excuse myself now, but it was
thank
lovely.
You so much.
Yes, thank you so much for having me here. It was great to be present and participate. So thank you.
Thank you. Bye. So if a child wakes up, for example, at 3 a.m. or 2 a.m. or 4 a.m. and a mom is sleeping in one room with him, but in different beds, and he can wake up with problem behavior, so or just go outside and have and travel around the flat, is this the stretch the mom can use too?
What is the strategy that they could use? Yes. So one thing I want to ask is, are they always in the same room together? Is that the goal?
No, it's just the possibilities of her flat. So they live in one room. Mm-hmm.
Great. Okay. So in that case, what I would do is, certainly try all of the antecedent interventions, try to find out, what you can put into your schedule in terms of those sleep hygiene. That would always be my first step. Being consistent, going to bed the same time each night, getting up the same time each morning, including even on the weekends. Make sure the bedroom is quiet, dark, relaxing, and at a comfortable temperature. Remove electronic devices such as TVs, computers, smartphones from the bedroom. Get exercise during the day and avoid large meals before bedtime. So if they've done all of those things, mm-hmm. they've eliminated any naps during the day, they've got a consistent bedtime and wake up time. All of that is going well, and at 3 a.m., the child is waking up from the bed and waking up the mom. Well, what I would do is actually, first of all, try to make that bed that the child sleeps in the most like their own space as possible. It's unavoidable that they will both be in the same room together, but what you can do is make it so that there's a little bit like a privacy partition or something mm-hmm. around the child's bed, giving space for the child to move around and things like that, but essentially create a boundary in that space for that child so that they, when they leave their bed, it's very obvious that they've left their bed. I say this because you want to delineate for the child what the consequence would be for leaving that space. If you can make it, in our field, we call it salient. We call it like creating a contrast, a difference. When he's in his bed, he should know he's in his bed and he's not just able to be around the whole flat. I would also probably close the door at night. Don't lock it, but close the door. The more sort of small ways that you can make a barrier teaches him that everything is good when he's in that space that he's supposed to be. When he's outside of that space, he's not going to get reinforcement. He's not going to get what he wants. So that's one thing, is to teach him to stay in that space. If they can get, you know, a privacy partition or something like that, then what would happen is, essentially, once the mother places the child in their bed, go outside of that privacy partition, set the timer, and only respond to the child when that timer has gone off. So what might happen, though, is that child will go in the bed and immediately get up and immediately maybe push on the mom, things like that. At that point, the mother is going to have to ignore the child, no eye contact, no responding to them. Is there a door to the bedroom?
I guess yes, but the problem can be, if she is not giving attention to him, the problem behavior can escalate.
Right. Right. So what I would say is that it might be very difficult for her to not give him attention if she's in the same room. I would put him in the bed, maybe not put the partition up yet, close the bedroom door, and set the timer for 10 seconds. He needs to learn to tolerate 10 seconds or 5 seconds of his mother not being in the room. He might escalate, but within 5 seconds, hopefully nothing bad can happen, right? If there is anything in the room that's dangerous for him to have, remove it from the room. If he's in a safe place for 5 seconds or 10 seconds without her there, it might take a long time for her to build up that tolerance. But essentially what we're teaching him is, it's okay to be in this room by yourself. And over time, we will gradually increase the amount of time he has to be in that room alone. And we do it so slowly that he doesn't really experience any bad side effects from that, if that makes sense. So it might take a while, but essentially he's learning to be by himself. He's learning to be in that space by himself. And over time, if you've done all the other preventive strategies, he's going to be in that space by himself and be tired and be more likely to actually fall asleep, right? But we need to have those antecedent strategies in place. I would not start with this, right? And then over time, as he's able to be in his own bed at night, she can start to put up a partition or something like that to make it clear that his bed is his bed, and it's wonderful and it's safe and it's cozy, and her bed is her bed. I tend to discourage people being in the same bed as their child, only because that child will never learn to sleep alone. There are some cultural elements to that. A lot of different cultures have different views on that, and I support whatever folks want to do. I will say it makes it a little bit harder for that child to ever learn to sleep alone, because they get used to that.
Yeah, I love the point that sleep is a skill too. I think this is a great point. And can we discuss one more example about this 10 years old boy, so who continues sleeping with mom or dad, and every time mom tries to put him in to his bed, he starts to whine, and it takes a lot of energy, like, for mom to motivate him to stay in his bed, and mom thinks that this is the point of searching some tactile senses, so he likes the feeling of warmth and etc. What can you advise in this situation? He has a good language development level. So this is also the important point. Maybe there are some other strategies to use too.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I would say that having verbal behavior skills helps a little bit in terms of explaining the circumstances, explaining the situation. You could use different stories and things like that. But I would say in general, especially in the middle of the night, it might just not even matter that much that that's the case. You could have visual aids and things like that if that would help. But I think ultimately one thing I would think about is he's a 10-year-old boy. Is he falling asleep with mom and dad? Is that what's happening?
I guess yes, but sometimes he just can't, he can fall asleep. No, I think, yeah, he wants to fall asleep with his mom and dad from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when I think about that, I think about that idea of what he needs to fall asleep initially will be the same as what it will be for him to want to be able to fall asleep at 3 a.m. So whatever his bedtime routine is, he's going to want that same thing when he wakes up at 3 a.m. or when the mom moves him into his bed. So let's say he falls asleep at 8 p.m. He's doing great with that, but he's with mom. Mom needs to be there for him to go to sleep initially. When mom's ready to go to sleep at, I don't know, 10 p.m., she picks him up and moves him and he wakes up in that process. Well, of course he's going to want her there to fall back asleep. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So,
but I think the idea here should be is it sounds like the ultimate goal for this family is for him to fall asleep alone initially. And so there are a lot of different ways to do this, and it's been actually well documented in the literature. The idea is to take a look. Again, I always say take a mental snapshot. What does it take for him to fall asleep? He needs mom next to him, right? A nice, cozy, warm body next to him. Okay, what can we do to replicate that and not have it be mom? Okay, there are really heavy, thick body pillows. It sounds a little strange, but if you get one of those and maybe a heating pad, right? And maybe just like you would disconnect or disassociate two stimuli from each other in any other circumstance, you can use those same principles mm-hmm. here. The individual, you know, the child is falling asleep with his body pillow, or I'm sorry, with his mother. What we want to do is have the mother do all the same things she's doing, maybe put the body pillow over here with the heating pad, right? Oh, after a few minutes, the mother says, you know, I'm going to go, or maybe she sort of slips out, or maybe she just builds a little space, right? Mm-hmm. And over time, after multiple nights, she starts to gradually move out. He can start to lean on this body pillow that has, you know, a mm-hmm. heating pad or something like that. I knew a child who required his mom to rock him mm-hmm. in a rocking chair while he twisted her hair.
The problem.
Replicating. And so, you know, it was very challenging to figure out how to replicate the rocking. And so what we did is we just said, okay, you're rocking him for 10 minutes, do it for 9 minutes. And so we slowly faded out the rocking, but he still needed mom's hair. Over time, we then got a baby doll with the hair. Okay. So, you know, it's just one of those things. I think if you think about them all as stimuli, and it's a little weird for us to think a parent is a stimulus, but they are. And, you know, we have stimulus properties like, you know, weight and warmth. And if you can find a creative way to replicate that, then you can start to fade. You can start to disconnect. Over time, my goal for this 10-year-old boy would be to go to bed himself. And if he needs a body pillow, that's not a big deal. You know, he could bring that with him on vacation. He could bring that with him to friends' houses if he needed to. But you've created independence for him in a way that wouldn't be the case without this intervention.
Great. I think it's very interesting to understand what strategies can use. It's an interesting point for parents. So I think they can analyze from their perspective and just see what can work and what they can replicate. This is a great stuff. Yeah. So I read your and your colleagues' research about the caregiver training model. So can you share a little bit more information about its structure and how you include parents in this process?
Sure. So you know, I think I mentioned one of the most interesting things for me as a behavior analyst is working with families, because to me, my perspective is not a medical perspective. It is a perspective of really respecting and appreciating the challenges that families face, and understanding that I'm a specialist, I'm a behavior analyst, I come into their lives for periods of time, right? My goal is to make it so that families don't need me anymore. If I can teach the parents what to do, then they don't need me and they get to have more control and independence in their life to then support their child. Many of the children that we work with in this population need long-term care. No matter how good we are at our job, many of them need a certain level of support beyond just, you know, their own autonomy. And so to me, if we teach families what to do and we teach families how to think about these problems a little bit differently, then they can solve them on their own over time. Just like you said about teaching families to analyze this differently. As a mother myself, if this was happening with my son, I might say, what am I doing wrong? Or maybe my son is sad and that's why he needs me. Of course, that's part of being a parent. When you have a behavior analytic perspective on it, you can start to think of it as more, okay, these are stimuli and I can teach this skill. And it's important to teach this skill because I want my kid to be independent. And so to me, that's the most fascinating part about my job is how do I get families to start to think in these terms and make their own lives and their child's lives better because they're able to do this teaching that might be sort of natural or easier to do perhaps if their child were typically developing. And so all of that said, the caregiver training model is this idea that if you're a caregiver for a child with autism, if we teach you what we know about behavior analysis, you can go off and do this work yourself and you don't need us anymore. And so the model really requires that the caregiver be engaged and motivated to learn these skills. Nobody that I've ever worked with has wanted a stranger to come into their home at 3 a.m. to help them with a sleep problem. Also, I've been to many people's dinner tables and nobody really wants me there, right? It's their family time. It's their time to be together and enjoy their dinner. So if I can teach them how to get their child to eat food, at the dinner table and how I can get them to sleep in their own bed. It's an intimate time for a family and they deserve to have that privacy and that opportunity to try these things. So the caregiver training model is really about respecting families and respecting the fact that, you know, families learning these skills can go much further with it. And they can be agents of intervention. Also, the way I think about it is that everybody's different and how they expect their child to eat at the dinner table and what they expect them to eat, what time they expect their child to go to bed and under what circumstances is unique. It's as unique as how your house is laid out or how you grew up. And so to me, it's a give and take. So when families come to me and they say, I've got this problem, I try to just listen to what they want and try to help them learn how to make it happen for themselves. So what the caregiver training model is me listening to them, teaching them what to do, and then letting them do it and me supporting them.
Do you have some kind of workshops or trainings for parents so they can listen to the theory of this, of sleep and stretch tests and et cetera?
Yes, yes. So we actually wrote a manual. It's actually my mentors and from my doctoral program. Dr. Cynthia Johnson was the lead author on that. And we basically took all of the principles of behavior analysis and we made them family friendly. So we decided, okay, sleep is a problem. We have all of these preventive measures. We call them antecedent interventions. We have all these consequence interventions, how do we put this into a package to be able to read a script to a family and teach them kind of step by step what they should do based off of their individual problem? And along the way, ask them, how else could reinforcement help you? How else could these preventive strategies help you with the problems that you're facing or the difficulties that your child is presenting? And it really enriches that parent's knowledge base to be able to address other issues. Oh, my child's not buckling their seatbelt in the car. How do I address that? Oh, I remember. Mm-hmm. I used an intervention for sleep that I could actually use here by, you know, following it up with a reinforcer, right? So that we did basically one-on-one training with families, and we did different measures along the way. So we took a baseline measure and we monitored every session how things were going with their child's sleep. And we took actigraphy measurements, et cetera. And all of the kids, for the most part, improved. I think there were I'm trying to remember exactly how many participants we had in our pilot study, but it was along the lines of 20 or 22 participants, and one or two did not finish the study. They had actually biological reasons for their sleep difficulty, and they needed medication to sort of finish the job of that. And sometimes that happens, but I would say that for the most part, behavioral interventions are highly effective, and they're the way to go before we embark on any other more invasive interventions.
And I'm sure a lot of specialists will have a question, trainings and workshops they can attend to address sleep problems. Can you advise something for ABA specialists, for example, for behavior analysts?
Sure. So Autism Speaks is a great resource. They have a sleep toolkit. There are often webinars that they post on that website. I will also say I am more than delighted to provide free workshops to families. You know, we live in on Zoom these days, so I can, find a way to do that. But more and more there are trainings available. If any of your listeners are interested, they could feel free to contact me. You can share my email address.
Oh, that's great. A lot of information. I think this, of course, this is general information just to understand what sleep problems can be and what strategies you can use to address the sleep problems and etc. But it's a great introduction to understand in common how things happen. So thank you so much that you agreed to participate. I was happy about that. Yeah, maybe you have some last words to say, comments to our parents who raise children with autism.
Absolutely. You know, I just want to say that I think sleep problems are so challenging, and they're challenging for the whole family. And my heart goes out to people who are struggling with these issues, because it really does affect every part of their lives. But I want to share also that there's a lot of hope here. There's a lot of opportunity. I think just reaching out, asking for help, asking for additional information, and exploring behavioral interventions before other interventions is definitely the way to go. And if any family has any questions, concerns, wants to share their story, they can feel free to contact me. I'm fascinated by this subject, and I just want to help as many people as possible.
Thank you. This is great.